The Guardian.
Hello all, James Richardson here, and before we get started with today's edition of Football Weekly, I'm going to point you in the direction of our sponsor Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show. Today, Football Weekly, not going gentle into that international friendly flatline with some top football stories. Derby news, De Michelis in trouble for not making rash tackle as United do City, while Newcastle fans at last hail a manager doing his best to save them from relegation, Palace's Alan Pardew. Elsewhere, we check in on the title race, applaud Arsenal's successful bolting of the now almost vacant stable door, and fail to adequately mention your team's fixture. There's no time, because there's Spanish news, Turin derby, Nottingham Forest derby, other news and other things too in this Football Weekly. Anyway, listeners, so glad you could join us again, because I'm here with Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Barry's back from his, I was going to say week at Cheltenham, but it was week of Cheltenham.
Week of Cheltenham. I was shackled to the racing desk,
right,
helping Tony Paley out, while Chris Cook and Greg Wood lorded it up down in Prestbury Park.
All right. John Ashdown.
Hiya.
Anything you want to get off your chest?
Don't think so.
Okay, good. And Paolo Bandini's here with us.
Hello.
Who just told us, actually, that we were asking if he'd ever worn a dress, and he said no, but he did once wear a Banana Man costume. You were going to tell us, what was the worst thing about wearing that Banana Man costume?
Well, I don't know if it was the worst thing. It sort of just made you feel very self-conscious, is that when you're dressed up as a superhero in public, adults look at you, especially when you're surrounded by other men of late 20s, early 30s age, which is, it's now a good few years ago, but it was my stag do.
Oh, right.
This adults will look at you and judge you terribly because they'll think you are a lout out making a fool of yourself. But children look at you and see sincerely a superhero. So you have this awkward situation where there are kids sort of walking nearby with eyes wide and you're thinking, I'm a terrible human being because I'm sort of setting this example of walking along and drinking booze in the street and generally probably not behaving.
Wow, that's true.
Yeah.
You're basically destroying the brand. I've got to take issue with it. It was Banana Man a superhero? What was Banana Man?
Yeah, of course Banana Man was a superhero.
What was he?
He was a man who ate bananas and gave him
superpowers. Was he not a boy who ate bananas? It was a boy who ate bananas.
Wasn't it? Eric something.
Was he not a thinly veiled attempt by the Banana Marketing Board to destroy conception of the... No, basically, that's what it was. It was a bit like spinach with Popeye, no?
What was his superpower?
What was his super, John?
Well, he could fly, couldn't he?
Could you make people fall
credits
over?
I don't know if that actually happened in the real show.
Well, one of his arch nemeses was an apple, was Appleman.
There you go.
So it was bananas taking on, trying to destroy the apple industry, clearly.
Right.
Mr. Del Monte was all over that.
Wow. Where do the bananas and pyjamas come into this?
Oh, that's from Australia, isn't it? Isn't it?
Right.
Anyway, must move on then. A lot of important games. It seemed like every derby in the world that could be played was played this weekend. Apart from, of course, the one that in Istanbul they had to call off because of a terrorist threat. Most unpleasant, Galatasaray-Fenerbahce. But all the other ones went ahead. For example, the one at the Etihad, twixt Man City and Man United. Should we start with that? Ashes.
Yeah, I mean, it was a strange affair, really, because given that Newcastle and Sunderland had been actually pretty entertaining earlier on in the day, if pretty low quality, the actual game itself wasn't much of a thriller, really. Wasn't a great spectacle, and it was an odd feeling of having this Manchester derby when the thing that was at stake was a fourth place,
right,
rather than something a bit bigger than that. A lot of what happened so just confirmed the things that we kind of already knew.
Oh, right, okay.
In that, City have just become this disjointed mess, as disjointed and messy as United have been,
right,
for a lot of the season, which says something.
Right. Lots of great City stats. Daniel Taylor pointing out that they are sort of comfortably around 10 to 20 points down on their usual point tally at this point.
Yeah, and as far as United were concerned, it was a decent performance, and Rashford was again pretty much the bright spot, really.
Rashford, eh?
Yeah.
All that money spent, and it's the academy kids.
Yeah, I think it's been said before, it makes a difference when you have got youth team players coming in and making an impact. It just lifts any club.
Also makes a difference when you've got De Michelis in that kind of form. Well, it's hard to remember as comprehensively bad a performance as his. The tackle which he failed to make on
Rashford, then he should have given away a penalty. And then that marvellous back pass, which effectively landed Joe Hart in hospital.
Well, there's this... This obviously came up after the game with Van Gaal saying, basically saying he used to be a good player, but now he looks a little bit old. And he sort of was actually trying to say it, I think, in a not just horrible and cruel way, because as he pointed out, he's been his player before and he, you know, has a relationship with him. And he's like, you know, this is it's football and it's cruel. But it sort of actually raised this awareness with Guardiola to come in and take over this team, which obviously now we're talking about, are they going to be in the Champions League for him or not? But it raised this awareness with that City squad that when you start going through the team that played yesterday, it's not a young team at all. It's actually, you know, really quite old. And I think I saw that Fernando, when he came on, who goes on 29 in the summer, was the third youngest player on the pitch for City. And you think that Guardiola's going to want to presumably play the same style of football he's had at Barcelona, same style that's been at Bayern Munich, which is all about energy and pressing. And it feels like the whole squad is going to need to be basically stripped and rebuilt if he's going to actually play the sort of football that we sort of expect him to play.
Manchester City won none of their 9 matches, not a single one of them, against teams in the current top 6 this season. But for all of that, they are still in 4th place, still a point above West Ham, who are level on points with Man United. So I'm not sure. How do you feel that the landscape has changed in terms of that dogged battle?
Right now, of those teams, the one that's been performing most consistently well is West Ham. And West Ham, you know, that's this strange situation of being and going to Chelsea, where they are not accustomed to winning games. And all right, they didn't win, but in the end, they were, you know, quite narked not to have won.
Did you sympathise with them? Their complaints over the late penalty, which gave Chelsea a point.
It was a mistake. It shouldn't have been a penalty. The tackle was clearly outside the box, and the ref got it wrong. But I would argue that West Ham should have put the game to bed long before that. They certainly had the chances. They were by a mile the better team.
Great goal from Lanzini. Fabulous goal from Fabregas. That was his first direct free kick that he scored in the Premier League since 2009. Wow. So, more impressed with West Ham than the Chelsea fight back, Paolo. That's your view on that.
You know, Chelsea are showing a lot more spirit than we saw from them early in the season. And, you know, really, if this season had started when Hiddink took over, then they might be in that conversation as well. But I think what I was actually saying is just that West Ham are impressing me more than City or United at the moment, and that's the more relevant point at this point. Stage.
Okay, no longer presumably part of the top 4 conversation are Liverpool, who blew their chance, really, with that extraordinary collapse against Southampton down at St Mary's. Confidence is like a little flower, Jurgen Klopp has pointed out before this game, and if ever there was a match to but he went on to say, you know, if you step on it, it's gone. And boy, did Southampton step on his little flower.
Yeah, and you know, it was as late as the sort of 75th minute, you had Benteke going through on goal and Liverpool 2-1 up, and you think this game's done, and then it wasn't. And I think that, in all honesty, we have to say that this is not the first time, maybe not the sort of direct as being 2-0 up and then blowing it like that, but it's not the first time we've seen Liverpool involved in the game this season where they've sort of had periods of looking scintillating going forwards and periods of looking absolutely calamitous at the back.
And right,
obviously happened in the 3-3 draw against Arsenal. The way Southampton came back into it was obviously very admirable. I thought it was very pleasing personally, because I'm a big fan, to see Graziano Pelle scoring his second goal in consecutive games, which I think he hasn't done in like a year and a half. Mane is obviously fantastic for Southampton at the moment. And look, you know, they are Southampton. It's an outside shot, but when you look at the points gap between them and the top 4, it's not out of the question. Certainly, the Europa League spot is not out of the question, and I think that's a real credit to the way they've turned things around in the second half of the season.
Yeah, they're 4 points off the top 4, but all the teams ahead of them in that race have a game in hand on them.
I'd say you could probably safely write Manchester City's chances of finishing in the top 4 off.
Really? Even though they're 4th at the moment?
Yeah, I just think the way they're playing, and with the back 4 they're going to be forced to field in the coming weeks, I just can't see them getting the necessary points. I think they'll definitely be overtaken. It's just a matter of who does it.
Right.
You know, I could be wrong, but if you look at the back 4 they're going to be forced field through injuries. And it's not very good, is it?
Well, Results seem to be bearing you out. Of course, they've got PSG as well in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, which could be highly entertaining.
Sorry, just one thing about the Southampton-Liverpool game. Mm-hmm. There was a very good, entertaining vine going around when Daniel Sturridge was celebrating his goal with his traditional Sturridge dance, dad dance. You could see a small child, I think, sitting on his dad's knee in the stand, just give him the finger. Held his finger aloft, and his dad suddenly clocked what this young boy was doing and just quickly moved to put his hand down and admonish him for his loutish behaviour. Mm.
I was heartened that the father did step in,
yes,
yeah, as opposed to encouraging the child.
Do you know the goals in that game, though, which in general were excellent, and that Sturridge goal, he sort of did this shimmy with his left foot before hitting it that was just one of those moments that required repeat viewings because it was... was sexy football, but yeah,
it was sexy, wasn't
yeah,
it?
There was a lot of there were some very good goals. Both ends scored in that game.
Brought a smile to your face, if not to his.
Yeah, well, I think it brought a smile to his for a little.
Did
while.
It? Yeah, a little flash of a smile. Anyway, Southampton looking good. I see Jay Rodriguez is back training with their under-21s, their youth team, and he should be available after the international break when they will be welcoming at St Mary's who Leicester. That's going to be a game, isn't it? Hey, we're talking about Leicester and their continued excellence at the top of the table. In a couple of seconds. There you are. It was literally a couple of seconds, listeners. Title race. 5 points still between Leicester and Spurs. Leicester, who've now won 13 games by a one-goal margin this season, more than any other team since the dawn of the Premier League. Wow, indeed. Spurs, they turned up the swaz, didn't they, on Sunday when they did for poor old Bournemouth.
Yeah, and they could have won by any number. Kane was brilliant, Ali was brilliant. And it was, I think it's the sort of game where, particularly if you're, you know, in that sort of slightly pressured situation, Leicester having won on the Saturday, getting the early goal makes such a difference, and they were ahead.
It was early as well, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, it was very, very early.
Right.
So yeah, pretty routine, and you know, pretty impressive.
Right, very impressive.
It was the mirror image, wasn't it, of their game against Bournemouth? Not in total, but certainly the start of the game against Bournemouth away from home, where they conceded immediately. Oh. I thought it was perfect for Tottenham and where they are at this point in the season. And obviously, winning 3-0 at home is always perfect wherever you are in the season. But just. Again, you know, I sort of feel like we're now far enough into the season and we're really not seeing it in the way that it was some people have billed it. But this idea that Pochettino teams tire as the season goes on because they work so hard.
Right.
When you score twice that quickly in a game and you can play the next 70 minutes at a sort of, you know, not quite a jog, but, you know, certainly a canter instead of a gallop, it all helps. It all helps towards being fit enough to win the games coming up, which are going to be, I imagine, more exerting, have that little bit extra left in the tank.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so Harry Kane's now got 5 goals in 2 games against Bournemouth. Wow. Yeah. But equally impressive, Riyad Mahrez now got 16 goals and 11 assists for the season so far. And it was him who did the goal away at Crystal Palace. Do you remember when the owners came in? They're from Thailand, I think, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they said Champions League within 5 years. Did we all think it was a bit of a Venky moment? You remember when Venky's took over?
I'd imagine we were all tittering and sniggering.
I'm sure we were.
Yeah, but must have been.
But this is, what, 2 years later?
Hmm.
Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing the simple things brilliantly. Their defence is pretty watertight. They've kept 3 consecutive clean sheets. And it's theirs to lose. So here's hoping they don't lose it.
Hmm. Well, they show no signs of doing so at the moment, although that Southampton, of course, have just proved with that Liverpool match that 2-0 really is the most dangerous scoreline. but that's going to be a tough match. A couple of things just want to mention about the Palace-Leicester game. One, Frankenstein 4-5-1. Ask why referees allow so much flagrant fouling in the box. He cites the example of Robert Huth, who, you probably saw this fine, had his shirt entirely taken off.
Yeah.
By Scott Dann, and yet the referee did nothing.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that question. I mean, if referees penalised every indiscretion that takes place in the box, then they would every corner would result in a penalty until players got the message.
This, though, has to be like a player going down in the area. He either has to book Robert Huth for taking his shirt off or Scott Dann for doing it for him.
Simulating taking his shirt off. Well, it was his body shape as well, wasn't it? If Huth was standing erect, it would be very, very hard to take his shirt off.
Right.
But if he's bent over, when he's bent over, his position made it quite easy for the defender to slip his jersey off, I thought.
We should try this now, actually, to see how difficult it is. I know that the materials they use are a lot more giving, but still, I was impressed by that.
Are you suggesting, actually, that the shirt fell off?
No, simply that, like, okay, so if you took your shirt from here, I'm tugging my shirt, sat in my seat for anybody.
Kind of lower ribs area. Yeah.
That's different from if I'm bending over and tugging it like this.
Do you think that's where, is that where he grabbed it? Yeah. I assumed it was from the bottom and then he moved away and the whole thing came off.
The Huth's, like, body was, his torso was flat, I thought.
I'm more confused than ever now. Okay.
I'm not saying it wasn't a foul, but it was just the way that it came off.
Yeah,
was
but the referee
so easy.
Might have spotted, hang on, player without shirt. Hasn't scored a goal.
It was a foul, certain. Yeah. But it just looked more spectacular because of Huth's lateral torso position.
Right, okay.
I think if the referee had awarded a penalty for that, it might have set a dangerous precedent insofar as in the future we would have players lumbering centre halves going up for corners and just removing their own shirts and throwing them on the ground.
Yeah. They'd have Chippendale style Velcro tags.
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe the referee thought, I can't handle this. Bleak future.
That does make sense. Oh, by the way, just on the subject of Leicester and their owners, the Asian football investments, that was actually 2010 when they took over. So we are going to be outside of their five-year plan.
So we were right to laugh at them.
We were right to laugh at them. Yeah, good. I feel vindicated. And you know who else does? Arsene Wenger. 2 wins in his last 10 games in all competitions. Hand that title over. Happy days are here again. Token Arsenal fan Paolo Bandini.
Yeah.
Do you feel back in the title race?
Not really, no. I think I find it hard to believe the way Leicester are playing at the moment. They're going to even necessarily drop enough points for Arsenal to be back in the title race. I mean, they're 11 points behind now. Obviously, game in hand, theoretically, could get you to 8 points. But do I necessarily believe that Leicester are going to lose 3 of those last 7 games, which is what they basically need to do? I don't see that that's either indicative of their form or necessarily the fixtures they've got less. Nor do I think it's indicative of Arsenal's form that they would win all of their remaining 8. So, no, I think it's pretty improbable. I think, definitely Tottenham are still very much in the hunt. I think, for me, it's not realistic for anyone else, really, other than those two to win at this stage.
At least Arsenal have.
But if nothing else, yes, Arsenal have put a bit of a gap between themselves and 5th and 6th and back to that qualifying for the Champions League trophy that everyone loves to talk about.
You think West Ham could be in the top 4? Now, they look the likeliest of the two Manchester sides and West Ham to make the top 4.
Why not? They're 1 point behind and they're playing better football right now.
In which case, should we cut Arsenal a bit of slack, given that in the season, which saw the big 4 of English football completely go off the rails, Chelsea way down the path, the two Manchester sides out of the picture, Arsenal are going to be the only ones who survive in the Champions League positions.
At a certain point, you need to separate out what everyone else is doing and just look at, over the course of a league season, do you amass enough points to be progressing? And look, I'm definitely not someone who has been stood on the terraces holding up big banners saying Wenger out at any point in the past, and nor am I today. But I do think that we can... There is a middle ground here in which you can avoid that sort of hystericism and yet at the same time ask genuinely if enough progress is being made, and if it's not being made, whether or not changing the answer is the thing that needs to happen. Look, there's a lot of other things that have been not ideal at Arsenal, and Amy Lawrence wrote a fantastic piece for The Guardian not long ago about Stan Kroenke and the fact that fundamentally he doesn't seem to be driven to make this a winning team. He's happy as long as it's a profitable team, and that's when your owner has that goal, then that is going to set the terms of engagement, I guess, to an extent. But it was getting back to what we were actually talking about. I guess it was an okay win at the weekend. Everton were very bad at times, but Arsenal played well.
Right. And Alex Iwobi. Yeah. Another of Wenger's kind of classic mid-season finds.
And this is exactly what John was saying about Rashford at United. It immediately makes the whole world look rosier, I think, for a fan of any team when someone comes out of your youth team and plays well. And Iwobi played well and got his first Premier League goal, and that definitely makes the sunshine a little bit brighter.
Lovely. Everton, eh? They could do with somebody coming through, because is that, let's see, one win in the last 10 at home. They only had two shots on target. Yikes.
Yeah. It's a strange team. People have been sort of saying quite a lot this season that they should be doing better than they actually are. And
do you know who was saying that this weekend?
Who was saying that?
Romelu Lukaku.
Well, but he's allowed to say that because he's the one exceptional talent that they have. Mm. If you look at through the rest of the team, you know, people like Cleverley and McCarthy and, you know, Lennon and Funes Mori, like, they're good players, but they're not exceptional. And everybody in the Premier League has got good players these days. So
right.
Everton aren't far off, I don't think, from where they should be.
Really. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you not think that I've lost count of the number of occasions they've thrown away winning positions. And I think that's the main criticism rather than that they're underachieving, so that they get themselves into these great positions and then blow it in spectacular fashion and do it far more often do it so often that it's more than just bad luck.
Yeah, well, it's players not being good enough in part as well. I mean, they didn't have Gareth Barry on Saturday and missed him horribly. And no team that got sort of Champions League sort of pretensions should miss Barry that badly.
Mm.
Yeah. We always miss Barry here, obviously. But.
Oh, yeah. Okay, anyway, that was Arsenal and their 2-0 win over Everton, which should make their top four status look a little bit more likely. Huh. We're going to take another little break now before we get onto the meaty business down the bottom.
Hello, and welcome to another day of export opportunity. UK style is admired the world over. South Korea want our fine suit fabrics. Sweden want our classic country clothing. And Switzerland want our dazzling cocktail dresses. Whatever your business, find your opportunity at exportingisgreat.gov.uk.
Hey, Dublin-based listeners, or those making a journey to the Irish capital, to join us on Tuesday evening at Vicar Street. You'll be pleased to know that doors open at 5:30. Ringo Music Bingo will be doing a half-hour set from 6, and then there's more music until we hit the stage at 7, and not just any old music, either, it says on Ben's notes, with a rather ominous dot, dot, dot there. I really don't know what he means there. It's going to be a special night of Live Football Weekly. By the way, we welcome your questions because it saves us thinking of any. If you tweet them with the hashtag FWDub, FWDUB, that is, the best one will be getting a brand new 16-gig iPad Air courtesy of the nice people at Football Manager. Apparently there's a few extra tickets being made available. So look at ticketmaster.ie. Ooh, how about that relegation battle now? How many points is it now? Well, it's kind of as it was. So you've got Norwich. Let's have a look. Villa are gone, surely. And Remy Gard may be gone today for Nigel Pearson, they say.
Yeah, it sounds like a logical thing to
do. With, what, 7 games to go? Yeah.
Well, I think they should have, rather than bring Remy Gard in, they should have started planning for the Championship quite some time ago.
Right.
Because they were clearly doomed. And with the greatest respect to Remy Gard, who may or may not be a good coach, I think he got himself into a horrible mess there, that it possibly wasn't a good career move that early in a fledgling management career. But Nigel Pearson is better acquainted with the Championship than he is, has experience in getting teams out of it, and will probably do a good job there.
If he goes there. Yeah, Remy Gard, he's done what they call in the business a Gary Neville, basically. Joining early on in your manager. No? Doesn't work for you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. They also, Villa, ruthlessly axed their chief executive and the sporting director last week. So, wow. Swinging changes.
I've always wondered about that, actually. Swinging is the correct pronunciation.
I don't know. I used to call it swinging changes. Well, that would be a different kind of change.
Involving car keys and a
bowl. Well, it might. I don't know. I don't know if that's how it's done these days. Well, anyway, that means that Villa are in the bottom three, of course, and Newcastle are in 19th place, Sunderland are in 18th place, and then 2 points clear of them are Norwich now. Norwich, who went and won at West Brom. One shot on target, and it went in. Robbie Brady with that. And Norwich also keeping their first clean sheet away and got their first win since the 2nd of January. What's also exciting, if you're a Norwich fan, and we all know someone who is that their next three fixtures are against Newcastle and Sunderland at Carrow Road and Crystal Palace away. Hoo-hoo-hoo! Eh? So, I mean, the Canaries, if they really have embarked on a new direction and they went and had a bit of a team bonding exercise together, then they could really ruffle some feathers, no?
Or they're playing the relegation rivals, it could all backfire.
That's also true. That's what makes it such a fascinating...
I'm getting worried about Norwich, though, because they've kept two consecutive clean sheets, and you could always generally rely on them to concede at least two goals a game or possibly more. I think there was one stage in a run of six or seven games they were letting in an average of three a game with some calamitous defending, and they seem to have sorted that problem out.
Right, so doesn't that suggest that the next game might be a clean sheet as well? Snootley O...
No, that's what I'm saying. That,
oh, right. But you said you were worried about Norwich.
I'm worried about them from the perspective of me as a Sunderland fan.
Ah, of course. Right. Okay. Because Snootley O was saying, when you're considering a long winning streak or losing streak, and obviously two games doesn't really quite constitute that.
It does when you're down there.
That's true. But he was referring to Palace and the fact that they haven't won a game in 2016. Isn't it faulty to bet on the continuation of the streak? Doesn't the fact that the streak's been going a long time suggest that the ending of the streak is more likely to happen? And I mean, I was fascinated. You as a inveterate and you know.
Well, is this similar to the thing of, say, tossing a coin 10 times? So it's, say you toss a coin 9 times, right, and it comes up heads each time. When you toss it the 10th time, the odds of it being heads is still even money.
Absolutely.
Same as, you know. It's like the weather. You know, if it's sunny today, it's... Yep. It's 70% likely that it'll be sunny tomorrow as well.
I'm not sure how that's relevant, John.
No, because it's the streak, isn't it? If it's a sunny streak, then you're going to stay...
But that depends where you are in the world.
No, it's 70%.
Well, the ending, say, of a Crystal Palace not winning streak...
Yes. Anyway...
It depends on who they're playing.
Absolutely. Our John W. says that business of going, oh, well, they haven't won in ages, and they've got to get a win sometime. It sounds right to a lot of people, which is why it has a name, the Gambler's Fallacy. Have you heard of that, Barry?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, the game, which they didn't win, as it turned out, although they had a good stab at it.
Should have won it.
Jermaine Defoe. Was that his eighth away goal in nine matches on the road? I think it was. Very nicely taken, though.
Yeah, it was a good goal. There was an element of luck in that the clearance came to him in the first place. Newcastle's defending was poor. And, yeah, he did well to shoot through sort of a thicket of legs to get it into the goal. And just before half-time, Sunderland were very dominant for pretty much the first hour and then threw it away. And that's the second game in a row they've thrown away. It's sort of 4 points dropped when they should really have got six.
A point on the road, though, is that not still good news?
No, I don't think so. It's better than nothing, but only marginally, in my opinion.
Well, for Newcastle fans equally, the side of a battling Magpies side coming back to equalise it, through Mitrovic, who then performed that wonderful celebration. Did you see that?
Well, I don't know if we can give him all of the credit for it, because it was enhanced by the arrival of a stranger from stage left.
Right.
Who, sliding... sort of slid in at a slightly dangerous angle towards his feet, and he sort of hopped over him and then turned around and hugged him.
Did he not leap as if to embrace him, but the Newcastle fan fell over at the exact wrong moment, and he was left in midair. Yeah. He left him hanging, basically.
I mean, before that, he'd sort of charged off doing a sideways helicopter with his shirt, which... Don't get me wrong, obviously, as Barry was just saying, not losing this game is a lot better than losing it. And it's the derby, and they've lost seven in a row as well, Newcastle, so on that level, significant. But it did feel a bit like a hollow victory when you realise that goal is going to still leave them 3 points adrift of Norwich and, you know, having failed to pick up 3 points against one of the teams that they're directly up against.
Right. So a lot of people saying this means that one of these two teams will go down. But, I mean, to me, it seems there's still a lot of games left in this season, especially given the kind of turnarounds we've seen of late from Sunderland and Leicester last year.
Well, Sky were kind of peddling the game as a relegation off, you know, whoever loses goes down, which clearly wasn't going to be the case. But I think it certainly makes it more difficult. The draw isn't a huge amount of use to either side, but losing would have been a catastrophe. So, you know, there's still plenty to play for. Just going back to Mitrovic, I thought he spectacularly stole the show, because there was one stage it looked like he was going for the ref, like he'd lost it and was going to physically attack him. And he sort of took two or three paces towards the ref and then just clearly saw sense. There was this conflict going on in his head, and the angel on his shoulder won out, you know, and he just stopped very abruptly. And then he got that serious head injury, which everyone thought was hilarious. But he didn't want to come off the field, and Newcastle had used all their substitutions, but he clearly didn't know what day of the week it was or where he was. But, you know, bravely wanted to stay on, but was sensibly forced off by Rafael Benitez, who, I don't know if you're aware of this, was wearing South Park socks.
Not the first time.
No?
He wore them. He used to wear them in Italy. They're from his daughter's.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it was Cartman dressed as a policeman.
Really?
I thought it was maybe a subliminal message to those detractors who accuse him of being a fat Spanish waiter. He's saying, I'm not fat, I'm big boned.
There you go.
Is that when Cartman saying, respect my authority?
Yep. Yeah.
Maybe he's trying to get over an authoritarian message.
Right. I guess the whole thing about this idea that one of them will go down is that only one of them can be bailed out by Norwich, unless a second team drifts down to join this happy throng down there, a second team in the shape of Palace, which was the reason that Stutlio was posting in the first place. Is this run going to continue? And with 5 points now between Palace and Norwich, and with Alan Pardew looking increasingly ragged, I don't know if you caught his programme notes ahead of the Leicester game, where he basically slagged off Jamie Carragher and Leicester for being lucky.
Yeah, it was a very, very strange set of programme notes. It was sort of, you know, they've not quite saying they've fluked their way there, but it, almost saying if it wasn't for a bit of luck here and there, that, you know, Palace could be doing exactly the same as Leicester.
Instead of being on a one-way ticket to Palookaville.
They've got a horrible run coming up as well. They've got West Ham away immediately after the international break. Then they've got that huge game with Norwich.
Mm.
Then they go to the Emirates and then to Old Trafford. And all that before the FA Cup semi. So they could end up in that semi-final in a right pickle in the league.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's going to be interesting, isn't it? A little bit too interesting for some.
Who?
Well, people whose teams are down there.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Interesting in the Chinese curse sense, the word. Right. Now, love it when listeners have their say. Listeners like Michael Chilcott. Jimbo, I was listening to the pod on the way back from Doncaster. When just outside Loughborough, I saw lights from a football stadium. It turns out that it belonged to Shepshed Dynamo. Are you familiar with them, John?
I've heard of them.
They're third in the Midland Football League Premier Division. But what really caught Michael Chilcott's eye was their address. It's the Dovecote Stadium, of course. 10 Butthole Lane.
Made me laugh.
Well, it made me laugh as well. Palace having a chuckle as well. Barry, you don't get
it. I'm smiling.
Yeah, okay. In other news, El Californio says, hey, the earthquakes play on neither the San Andreas Fault nor the Hayward Fault. They actually play between them. So there you go. So this whole business calling them the San Jose Quakes. And then he makes a comment about the most controversial part of the name in the 70s was, in brackets, in inverted commas, San Jose. But why would that be controversial? Were they not based in San Jose?
I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, California, get in touch.
It's not atypical for major American sports franchises to have the name of a city that is not actually where they end up being based. Oh. Indeed, the San Francisco, in that region of the world, the San Francisco 49ers have their home stadium in Santa Clara.
Exactly.
So,
In other MLS news, Dave Zakilla, which is a worrying name, he says, as presumably the only listener of this fine podcast from the great state of Colorado, I feel compelled to inform you that the Rapids play in a suburb of Denver called Commerce City, which he says is a truly awful place, but it's 5,207 feet high, which is about a mile, isn't it? I mean, Denver's mile high, that's the point, isn't it? Anyway, MLS, we love it. Do you follow it? Because after your years in America, Paolo, do you watch MLS?
I've got a little bit less consistent in my following of it since coming back, but I try and keep a...
Have you seen any of this season?
highlights of Jovinko doing beautiful things, mostly, but I haven't seen a whole game this season, though.
All right.
I believe Steven Gerrard limped out of LA Galaxy's most recent game.
Do you know who they were playing?
No.
Only San Jose, the Quakes.
Okay.
Yeah, baby. I think so. That was a California derby, of course. And here's another one. Dear producer Ben Jimbo and others, that's you guys, Dave Gresty, who's in a village near Prague, says, a friendly reminder not to forget about the biggest derby of the weekend, which was Sparta Prague in an electric Prague derby beating Slavia 3-1. They're on quite the roll at the moment, Sparta, because as Dave's eager to point out, they demolished Lazio at the Stadio Olimpico Thursday evening. 3-0, quite the shot that was in the Europa League. Anyway, he urges us to have a wonderful week. Oh, he says this is all relevant because it's only a matter of time before the Czech Sinot Liga has more European places than Serie A.
Right. So, just one little question, actually, for you, Jimbo and Paolo, and Ashers, if he has an opinion. But as far as I know, Andrea Pirlo had a very bad season with New York City. And I was just wondering if that's because he's just phoning it in after his long career in Serie A, or if it's because he's not used to playing with players who aren't very good.
I think you could possibly take a little bit from both parts there. I think there's also the fact, realistically, that Andrea Pirlo, even towards the end of his time at Juventus, was showing his age. I do think there's something that came up time and again when I was in America and when I sort of looked at the players who haven't done well over there, and that is that the attitude is hugely significant, and players who go over there thinking it's going to be a doddle tend to get unstuck pretty quickly, because it's a very high tempo league, it's a very high intensity league, and if you think you're going to get away with strolling a lot of the time, you're not. Now, I will say that Pirlo, for all he wasn't brilliant in New York City last season, I mean, you know, in his sort of, you know, so laid back he's nearly horizontal way, did do, you know, did have a few games and a few moments that were actually quite exquisite, but he certainly is at a point of his career where I think his mentality is probably not the one which you require to really go over there and be a success, which is the exact opposite of Jovinko, who went over there feeling like, you know what, I'm going to go over here and I'm going to prove a point to people, and that's what he's done.
Right, there you go. Speaking of phoning it in anyway, let's get Sid Lowe on the line.
Hello, Jimbo. I'm here.
Yes, he's there, everybody. Sid, so good to hear you. I don't know why it's been so long, but it really, really has. And now we're going to hear from you today. We're going to see you quite literally in person in Dublin. And it's just brilliant. Lots of things to talk about.
That's quite exciting, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, last week was great for the Spanish in Europe.
It turned out quite nicely for them, didn't it?
Only one foreign team, love these stats, only one foreign team managed to score a goal against the Spanish side in either the Champions or Europa League. Who was it, Barry?
Arsenal.
There you go. And only one Spanish side dropped out, and that's because they were beaten by another Spanish side. Which team was it? Yeah, of course it was Valencia, wasn't it?
So it's the one Spanish team with English influence is the one that's out.
Yeah, there you go. Come on.
They're actually the only Spanish team to have been knocked out of European competition all season, because obviously if you look at Sevilla, who are knocked out of the Champions League, they stayed in European competition.
Right, yeah.
So I know that's a sleight of hand, but all the Spanish teams are still in except for them because they face the Spanish team.
Right, well, you don't need sleight of hand to paint the situation at Valencia as being pretty dire at the moment. They lost 4 of their last 5, were roundly booed throughout their game with Celta Vigo this weekend, and that was while it was still 0-0 before they conceded 2 late goals. Where are they now in the table, Sid?
I was just about to look for the table for you. They're 6 points off the relegation zone, so in theory could find themselves in trouble.
All right.
They shouldn't, to be honest, but then we've been saying that for the last, 3 months or something, that they shouldn't be in trouble, that maybe they can get Europe. And I must admit, after the game on Thursday night, I was sort of looking at the table and thinking, well, if they beat Celta, that puts them 8 points behind them with 8 games to go. And if they get a little bit of a run at it, who knows, maybe European place is possible. Of course, they then lose to Celta, who, by the way, a couple of the goals they scored were absolutely brilliant. And things look really bad again, really bad as well, because not least because the fans turned on Neville in a way that I think they haven't done until now. And Neville, back in, talking about probably about 6 weeks or so ago, there was a press conference in which one of the journalists said something like, you know, the fans are against you. And Neville said, whoa, hang on a minute. Please don't put this on the fans. One of the good things about Valencia's fans is they're very clear. When they turn on you, you know about it because they chant that chant, which is Vete ya, in other words, go now or leave, please. And this weekend they did it. Right. With Neville, and this weekend they did turn on him a little bit. Not particularly pleased with his substitution. Not pleased with the way things went. Obviously, off the back of the Europa League exit. Neville also said something very interesting in midweek, which I think was kind of reinforced this week with the weekend's games, which is that they'd been dreadful the weekend before and the loss of the Valencian derby to Levante, a team that's bottom of the table, and played so badly that Neville basically came out and said, look, I cannot defend this. There's absolutely nothing I can say to try and justify what we've seen. This is terrible, blah, blah, blah.
Well, he had a go at his players, though, didn't he? After that game, which featured a great goal from Pepito Rossi, who also scored a good goal.
Yeah, really good. He scored a brilliant goal again this weekend as well, yeah. By the way, Rossi. Mm. Really brilliant.
But after that, so after the Levante game, didn't Neville say basically the tenets of footballer that you are, of a football match, are that you try at least as hard as the opposition, you commit at least as much to the opposition, and I can't say that about my players.
Exactly. And then what he did was kind of implicitly, well, I actually think reasonably explicitly, but I suppose you could give him the benefit of the doubt on that. On Thursday night, he followed that up because they were very, very good against Athletic Bilbao and very unfortunate. And the big, if you like, the kind of the talking point in the Valencian media is we've been robbed again because the goal that Athletic score that knocks them out starts with a handball. But afterwards, Neville said, you know, this is what I want to see. They were quick, they were aggressive, they went for Athletic. They were, in terms of attitude, totally different to previous games. And he was asked, well, how do you explain the enormous difference between this and what we saw 4 days ago in the Valencian derby? And Neville said, well, I don't need to say anything. You've seen it. And in other words, what he was saying is, you know, that although he said he claimed that he'd been proud of his team, I think the bottom line is he was pissed off with them as well. As if to say, oh, right, what now you try? And what about all the other games? Do they not count? And then he was saying, right, we need to see this again at the weekend against Celta. And deep down, even on Thursday night, he knew he wasn't going to see it.
Right. So he's delayed his return to England to his assistant coaching job with Roy Hodgson until Thursday.
He's not going until Thursday, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Because basically, politically, it would have been disastrous for him to leave after this.
Yeah, I mean, Neville's in a slightly weird position with this. And he joined Valencia knowing that he has this England position. Valencia know he has this English position, this England position. It's agreed with them that you know, you have this other job and you come. Part of the problem, I think, is that at its inception, Neville turned up at Valencia and the sort of the mindset was almost as if he was doing Valencia a favour, which, of course, from Valencia's fans' point of view, was always problematic. Now, obviously, you then go on and win and it doesn't matter, but it's problematic to say, hang on, so we've got this guy who has no managerial experience at one of the biggest clubs in Europe and we have to sort of feel like he's somehow doing us a favour. Isn't it the other way around? Now, admittedly, that kind of frustration or that sense didn't really come to the surface until results started going against them. And the problem with this England agreement is that it's in his contract and therefore it has to be honoured. And he admitted a week or so ago, look, I know it's not ideal. I know it's not perfect. I know it doesn't look quite right, but this is what we agreed. This is in my contract. And actually, we wouldn't have many players here to train anyway. On Sunday, he spoke to the club's owners after the game. And then came out to the press and said, OK, right, I'm staying here till Thursday. I'm not going to join England until then. The problem is, of course, that while a few people think, OK, well, that's good. You sort of back to where you've seen the importance of being here, the importance of making that gesture. But actually, most people just saw it almost as it kind of almost makes it worse, if you sort of mean.
Why would it make it worse?
Because it sort of underlines the fact that he's going. And then again, right. It comes back to that same thing. Oh, do we have to feel grateful now that you're hanging around for a few extra days? And that's not how, I don't think that's how Neville intended it to sound. But I think to some fans it did. And he said something about how, you know, I've got a commitment to England, a country of 65 million people.
Yeah.
But obviously I've got a commitment to Valencia as well, a city of 2 or 3 million. And I don't think he meant that to sound like he was saying, look, you're tiny compared to them.
Mm.
But I think given the environment and given how tense things are and given how badly they've performed and how everything kind of feels like it's burning at the moment, I think in a way that phrase probably didn't go down too well with too many Valencia fans. I was listening to one of the radio stations last night and the Valencia correspondent absolutely tore strips off him for that because he saw it as patronising and arrogant and... which again, I don't think was his intention, but I can understand why it gets read like that.
Right. Sid, you know, there's so many other things we want to talk about. The good news is we're going to see you Tuesday night in Dublin, and then we're going to get stuff there for Thursday's show. We're talking about the Spanish national side, how excited you are about the draw for the Champions League with Atletico Madrid taking on Barcelona and that.
So we'll keep our powder dry, shall we?
Let's keep our powder dry for that. In what's bound to be a very, very packed pre-international friendly show on Thursday. We're going to make a little bit of room for that. But many, many thanks for that Valencia update right now. And safe travels. We'll see you in Dublin.
Fantastic. Safe flight. See you there.
Thank you, Sid. Sid Lowe in Spain. Paolo, there's one derby we haven't mentioned yet. The Turin derby.
Indeed.
Sunday afternoon. And it saw, well, lots of good things. Saw a very special goal featuring Morata and Pogba.
Yeah, beautiful sort of turn and chip over the defence from Pogba that landed perfectly in stride for Morata to dispatch
it. His first touch to bring it down was pretty good. Anyway, what was it, 3-1?
4-1.
4-1.
Yeah, you know, I sort of, for me anyway, the story of the game, which is in a sense sort of silly because it only took 4 minutes of the game, but nevertheless, Gigi Buffon claiming the record for longest ever sequence in Serie A without conceding a goal, which is, in fact,
974 minutes.
Thank you.
I suddenly
realised I didn't know the number off the top of my head. 974 minutes.
Previous best was held by Sebastiano Rossi, who had the advantage of playing behind a back line that read pretty much like this: Tassotti, Baresi, Costa Curta, and Maldini.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is, this is a debate that actually happened on Italian TV last night. I don't know if you've seen the images. They got poor Seberossi in on Mediaset Premium, and they had him sat there watching. And it's fair to say that he did not convey sort of convivial good.
He's
for
not
him
a convivial
spirit.
Man.
No, he's not. No.
He looked mighty hacked off.
So yes, there was sort of vaguely uncomfortable TV with a split screen of sort of him glaring while the seconds tick down towards it happening. But yes, I mean, he had this exceptional defence. And what was interesting, actually, is alongside him in the studio, they had Ciro Ferrara, who was part of Juventus defence for a long time. And someone jokingly says to him, oh, hey, you know, how come Buffon never broke this record when you were playing with him? And he actually gets sort of serious for a moment and goes, well, you know, there were some pretty great attackers back then, with the implication being that Serie A is not what it was. And
right.
So actually Rossi's record is more impressive. And funnily enough, at the same time, or maybe not exactly the same time, but later in the evening, maybe on Sky, Beppe Bergomi is talking about it. He says, well, actually, I think it was easier to be a defender back when I was playing because basically you get away with kicking people is the short thing, which you can't do now. So there is this sort of this question of perspective of whether or not it's harder to keep clean sheets now or then. There's a question of the quality of the defenders in front of you. And look, no one should be under any illusions that 38-year-old Gigi Buffon, as good as he is the best version that there's been of Gigi Buffon. He's in this stretch, I think, it's more than 10 games it's encompassed, and it's he's made a total of 33 saves, and I can only think of one, which was from Eder against Inter, that was sort of particularly noteworthy. It is similar to Rossi's record, in huge part a testament to the defence that he's got, and right. I think maybe not quite on the level of the players you've mentioned at Milan, but I do think this... not that all three of them were present at the weekend, but this trio at Juventus of Chiellini, Bonucci, Barzagli, in fact, say them the other way around, and we can call them the BBC, which they do sometimes in Italy. And I think that group will eventually be remembered as a really fantastic defence, and I think rightly so.
Right. Shame about the four that they conceded the previous Wednesday, but never mind.
Well, not all of them were present for that game. And, you know, I think that game, clearly Juventus played it a lot better than most people thought they were going to, and it comes down to a lapse right at the end.
Mm. All right. They've had a derby in Scotland, Barry, as I'm sure you saw. Dundee against Dundee United, that's right. Finished 2-2.
Sorry, that one got away from me.
Yeah, Dundee United. Dundee, the D's, have finished with 10 men, but they got up to 7th. The Tangerines, that's Dundee United, are 7 points adrift at the bottom of the Scottish Premiership. Celtic are still 4 points clear of Aberdeen at the top. And quite the goal that... is it Tom Rogic? Yeah, scored against Kilmarnock. Apparently David Moyes wants the Celtic job.
So our own Ewan Murray was tweeting this morning about the forthcoming Old Firm derby in the Cup semi-final between Celtic and Rangers. Police have said they'll be monitoring fan forums to stay on top of any potential violence that's being organised by people who, according to the police, use mobile phones to organise these set twos.
They'll be all over the Guardian Football Weekly listeners page because there's always a lot of comment, especially after we've talked about Scottish football. But anyway,
the good thing about that Dundee United derby means you can't mix up the two Dundees as happened previously.
That's true.
Which incurred a tidal wave of McGrath.
Right. McGrath, yeah. John Ashton, how about an update on the Championship? Burnley, 4 points clear at the top, although they did finally see their six-game winning run come to a halt. A 1-1 draw with Wolves.
Yeah, it took an injury time equaliser from Danny Bath to do it. But the most remarkable story at the moment in the Championship is really Brighton, who are back up in second after beating MK Dons away at the weekend. You might remember that they had the longest unbeaten start at the beginning of the season. They were 21 games unbeaten. Were second in sort of mid-December. Lost their first game to Borough, who were top at the time. And then failed to win for another four matches, didn't score a goal, lost three of them, were sixth and heading in one direction by sort of mid-January. And then have turned it around again and are flying once more. Been the best team in the division pretty much since. Wow. They've got a great chance. I mean, they're only 1 point ahead of Borough, with Borough having a game in hand. But given sort of the slightly sort of wobbliness that's happening at the Riverside at the moment, given Karanka's situation.
That is weird, isn't it? So he walked out, and then he turned back up for work again the next week as though nothing had happened.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, there's sort of various rumours come out of the sort of local press and the reporters working up there, sort of exactly what has happened. The sort of suggestion seems to be that Stuart Downing wasn't being picked regularly by Karanka, and Downing was a bit of a sort of marquee signing, obviously, last summer by... made by Steve Gibson rather than Karanka himself, and that sort of came to a head in a team meeting on the Friday before the weekend game against Charlton. Karanka stormed out, took his ball home. Borough then lost against Charlton and lost against Rotherham as well. Before
everyone's losing against Rotherham.
Well, that's another sort of extraordinary thing. Neil Warnock's job there. They've won 4 in 5. Having been, 6 points from safety a few weeks ago, they're now 2 points clear.
Wow.
Incredible.
Just on the subject of Neil Warnock, what happened on this day in history, John?
Oh, it was at the Battle of Bramall Lane, around this sort of time.
Was it 2000? Yeah, 2002 was the Battle of Bramall Lane. Yeah. There you go.
One of the proudest moments in my club's history, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, you were saying about... So he's walked out, they lose those games, and then what happens?
And then everybody sort of, you know, well, we better sort this out then. And, you know, handshakes and hugs and a nice cup of tea, and everybody's sort of saying, at least, that they're happy again and the club were never going to sack him and he was never going to quit, and it's all fine and dandy.
So it wasn't like a Costanza where he quit and then saw the error of his ways and just walked in pretending he hadn't quit.
There you go.
Maybe it was that. Nice.
Now... we like Derby news. They're fifth. They beat Nottingham Forest in a lacklustre East Midlands derby, 1-0 there. To what extent was this inspired by their new football advisor borrowed from the Jordanian FA?
Well, I'm sure Harry Redknapp had a huge influence over proceedings from his sort of Svengali position. I don't actually know if he was even there.
He was there, apparently, okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's come in. He said he's not going to sign any players. He's just there to help out Darren Wassell, who's the youth team director that's kind of been thrown in at the deep end slightly, them having sacked Paul Clement a couple of months ago now, and things all sort of wobbling and, again, going a bit sort of down the drain. Quite what Redknapp's going to do that, I'm not entirely sure, apart from make Wassell feel slightly more uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. His knees have really... I imagine recovered then, if he's now able to get all the way from Bournemouth up to Nottingham Forest and then across to Jordan and back.
Yeah, well, presumably he's in some sort of, you know, motorised...
Still though, John.
Sort of Pope-mobile.
Still. Down at the bottom, that remarkable escape under Neil Warnock, as you say, has them out of trouble. With Bolton, who lost 6-0 against Bristol City, and Charlton, who've now lost 3-0 against Sheffield Wednesday... Mm. Almost down. It's what is it? One from
you'd imagine it's one from MK Dons, Fulham, and you know Rotherham are still in the mix.
Oh, even still in the mix, yeah.
They're on the recovery. I mean, Fulham's extraordinary down there. You know how they haven't managed to turn around that club, given the talent that's there. Insane.
Right. Okay. Producer Ben is urging us to just explain a little bit more. What exactly was the battle that took place at Bramall Lane?
It was a game between Neil Warnock, Sheffield United, and Gary Megson's West Brom.
The Ginger Mourinho.
Yeah, very much so. In which it started when United player George Santos, who had been playing for, I think it was Tranmere, but I might be wrong there, a year or so earlier, and had his leg broken by the West Brom midfielder, who I think was, again, also playing for a different club at the time, whose name, it was Andy Johnson, I think. And essentially, midway through the sort of second half, Warnock introduced George Santos to the fray, who immediately, you can see it on YouTube, it's one of the worst tackles you could ever likely to see. The ball breaks loose between them in midfield, and you can just tell from the moment that Santos, basically he sees his opportunity, sort of almost like Keenan Inge Haaland, launches two-footed into the air from sort of 5 yards away and connects with Johnson, gets immediately sent off. The sort of game had been sort of bubbling along, you know, in terms of pretty feisty stuff for a while. There was a fracas shortly afterwards when Patrick Soufo, another Sheffield United substitute, headbutted. I think he headbutted Derek McInnes, who's now a St Johnstone manager, at least three times in front of the referee, connecting once. He was sent off, and then so that United were down to 9 men, had used all their substitutes. And slowly, players just got injured and couldn't continue.
Mm.
The goalkeeper had to go off. Michael Brown had to go off. I think United were down to Ullathorne maybe had to go off. So basically, like the accusation was that Neil Warnock had told his players to feign injury in order to get the game postponed. And in fact, the game was postponed because they couldn't continue with 6 men on the pitch. But West Brom were awarded a 3-0 win, and the FA had an investigation, and no wrongdoing was found, I think.
Right.
So it was all above board and absolutely fine.
On this day, March the 21st, 2002. Wow. That is what you call a broad-ranging Football Weekly. So many, many thanks for providing such diverse topics and speaking so eloquently about them. John Ashdown.
No worries.
Paolo Bandini.
Cheers.
And Barry Glendenning.
Thank you.
Producer Ben. Taking out the bits that weren't quite as polished and eloquent. And you, listener, for sitting through it all. More awaits us on Thursday with what looks like being, I would say, a very special edition of Football Weekly Extra. For now, have yourself a super beginning of your week. Bye-bye.